Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso. We have a lot of hot topics on our show today, starting with a statewide school walkout held this week by parents, teachers, and staff protesting vaccine mandates for students. We interviewed some protesters in East County and also spoke with school officials on the walkout's impacts. In addition, we did an in-depth interview with Dr. Mark Sawyer from Rady Children's Hospital. He's a top pediatric expert on COVID-19 and vaccines, as well as an advisor to the FDA, county supervisors, and the governor. We asked him about the concerns raised by the parents and what people should know about the risks of COVID-19 for children versus the far lower risks of vaccines. Next up, we have a special report revealing that COVID-19 is the top cop killer in the nation and in California, causing five times more law enforcement officers' deaths nationwide than shootings. And yet, police unions are resisting vaccine mandates imposed by some departments. Find out how your local city ranks on officer vaccination rates on today's show. The FDA has issued a health warning about salmonella outbreaks caused by contaminated fresh onions from Mexico, sold in grocery stores and restaurants nationwide, and we'll have details. The Red Cross has a blood shortage, and you can help by giving blood on November 6th when San Diego State University hosts its annual Aztecs for Life blood drive. On Tribal Beat, hear why some local Native Americans in East County are joining efforts with tribes across the Southwest to oppose lithium mining near Hualapai land that could contaminate water supplies, as well as raising concerns over a proposed lithium mining operation at the Salton Sea in Imperial County. Local sports fans have some big news to cheer about. Top local high school sport matches will now be broadcast on TV's Channel 4, as well as streamed live on UrView. Learn more on today's show. We'll also have some Halloween pet safety tips from the San Diego Humane Society. And then on Crime Beat, news of a guilty plea of arson involving the burning down of Chase Bank in La Mesa and looting during last year's riot. From Public News Service's 2021 Talks, we'll have some national news headlines at the end of our show today, including Trump advisor Steve Bannon being held in contempt of Congress for defying a subpoena to testify about the January 6th insurrection, a new social media platform that Donald Trump has announced plans to launch, and deportation of some migrants by the Biden administration. And finally, from California News Service, we'll have a report on new congressional actions to regulate toxic forever chemicals known as PFAS, including a bill to protect the public from these dangers introduced by California Senator Alex Padilla. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ. California is the first state in the nation to require students to get vaccinated for COVID-19. Students will be required soon to be vaccinated for in-person learning, starting the term after the FDA approves the vaccine for their age level. The Pfizer vaccine is already approved for ages 12 and up, and approval for ages 6 to 11 is expected to happen very soon, based on recommendations made by the FDA's advisory panel and now awaiting full FDA authorization. On Tuesday, October 18th, over 300 parents, teachers, staffers, and students held a protest in East County against the state's COVID-19 vaccine and mask-wearing mandates. The local protest was held on the Grossmont Bridge over Interstate 8 in La Mesa, part of a statewide school walkout day over California's public health mandates during the pandemic. Participants waved flags and held signs, slowing traffic on the freeway as some motorists honked in support. We spoke with several parents regarding their concerns for their children's health. We also spoke with a top pediatric medical expert to address those concerns. And we reached out to two local school districts to get information on how the walkout impacted their districts. One of the protesters, Bree, held up a sign reading, "The Nazis had a phrase, it's for your safety. Familiar?" For Bree, the issue is all about personal freedom.
Hi, my name is Bree, and I am both parent and a teacher. I work for a school district in East County. We really want to discourage history from repeating itself, and we're
We also spoke with Donovan, a parent who was there with his young son. He voiced concerns about the safety of vaccines.
In my opinion, it's way too new to be putting in children's bodies. There's way too many serious side effects.
We asked Donovan about new data from the Centers for Disease Control, which indicates that unvaccinated people are now over 11 times more likely to die of COVID-19 than vaccinated individuals, and 6 times more likely to contract COVID. But Donovan said he doesn't believe it, adding that he recovered from COVID and doesn't think it's as serious or deadly as the media has reported. But in fact, over 726,000 Americans have died of COVID-19 to date, the Centers for Disease Control reports. And for the first few months this year, COVID was the leading cause of death in America, topping even heart disease and cancer. Governor Gavin Newsom says the mandates are about protecting our children and school staff and keeping them in the classroom. Vaccines work, he says, adding, it's why California leads the country in preventing school closures and has the lowest case rates in the nation. We reached out to 2 local school districts to assess the impact of the walkout. Colin McGlashan, Grossmont Union High School District's Director of Public Affairs, told us initial numbers suggest attendance was actually up district-wide on the day of the walkout. But La Mesa Spring Valley School District Superintendent David Feliciano told us that his district's attendance was about 5% below normal. And the walkout likely cost the district state funding due to loss of average daily attendance money. The additional student absences translated to a loss in revenue of about $29,000 for the day, Feliciano told us. The superintendent voiced this message on behalf of the district for students, teachers, and staff. First and foremost, our hearts go out to all members of our learning community who have lost loved ones to COVID-19, he said. We are in this together, and we are here to support you. We encourage those that have concerns about the COVID-19 vaccine to reach out to a trusted health professional about their concerns. He added that public health regulations are mandatory for school districts and that those decisions are made not by school board members or district staff, but by state and county officials. To address concerns raised by parents and teachers over the vaccine and mask mandates, we reached out to a top medical expert at Rady Children's Hospital. We asked him about the risks of COVID and the safety of vaccines for children specifically. And next up, we bring you our in-depth interview with Dr. Mark Sawyer. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine and the East County Magazine radio show, and I'm very pleased today to have with us our special guest, Dr. Mark Sawyer. Dr. Sawyer is the infectious disease specialist at Rady Children's Hospital. He's a vaccine expert on COVID-19. He's been consulted by the FDA for making recommendations on vaccines and boosters. He's done presentations to the supervisors, and I understand he also serves on a state advisory committee to Governor Gavin Newsom. So, Dr. Sawyer, welcome and thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure to be with you.
Well, ours as well. So, today I covered a protest out on a freeway overpass in La Mesa, which was part of a statewide walkout by students, parents, teachers who are protesting the state's vaccine mandate, some of the masks as well, but primarily the vaccine mandate. Some of the parents believe that COVID-19 doesn't really pose a serious risk to healthy children or teens. So can we start by asking you, how common or rare are serious cases of COVID in children, as well as deaths? And can you explain some of the complications that you've been seeing at Children's?
Sure. The frequency of serious pediatric COVID is higher than people think. We have had a couple of hundred children hospitalized right here in San Diego at Rady Children.
It's quite a few.
Around 75 or so in the intensive care unit. And another 75 with the mysterious inflammatory syndrome called MISC that happens after COVID in children, which we're still trying to figure out, but has the potential to have long-term damage to various organ systems that are involved. So to say that COVID is not serious is underestimating the virus.
Okay, thank you so much for clarifying that. Have you seen any worsening of this with the Delta variant, which we know is more contagious Is that hitting kids any harder than the original version?
Yes, just like with adults, we're seeing a surge in cases over the last couple of months here in San Diego and across the United States, which is attributed mainly to Delta, which is, as you pointed out, much more contagious. We're not sure it's a lot more serious than other strains, but just the sheer frequency of cases leads to some cases being severe.
Right. Let's talk about the vaccines themselves. Obviously, parents were concerned about the safety of the vaccines. Some of them voiced concerns specifically over things like, you know, blood clots or heart conditions in a handful of people that have had the vaccine. What should parents know about that? How safe are these vaccines?
Yeah, well, the first thing to say is it is true that there are some very rare but serious side effects from any of the COVID vaccines that we've studied so far. But it's very important to keep the numbers in perspective. In general, we're talking a couple of cases of severe side effect per million people getting vaccinated.
Yeah.
And if you do the math, you're somewhere between 20 or 30 or 40 times more likely to end up in the hospital if you're not vaccinated than if you are vaccinated. And that includes children.
Yeah, I saw a statistic from the CDC that they put out just recently within the last couple of weeks that said that unvaccinated people in general are 11 times more likely to die and 6 times more likely to contract COVID than unvaccinated. Is that holding true of children as well?
Yes, and we're seeing the same trends here in San Diego. So this is a clear indication to me that the vaccine works to prevent serious disease, at least.
Mm-hmm.
And so the best way to get your family protected is to get vaccinated. It's pretty clear.
Yeah. And we should note that some of the very things people worry about with the vaccines, you know, heart conditions, clots, which, as you said, is maybe, you know, one in a million or very rare. But COVID-19, I understand, can cause the same things, right? How common are serious effects like that from COVID?
Yeah, I've actually seen estimates that the rate of heart involvement is just as much with COVID as it is with the vaccines. And that doesn't even count so-called long COVID, which we're still trying to understand, but persisting symptoms for months after COVID infection, that also happens in children. So,
yeah. How common is long COVID in adults and children, meaning things that can last for months or years that can affect your brain, your heart, you know, your lungs, other organs?
Yeah, I wish I knew the exact answer to that. I've seen estimates all over the place from 5% to as high as 30% of people mm-hmm. with COVID having some persisting symptoms. It's something that we're still trying to completely understand mm-hmm. from a medical perspective, but it's very real and happening to lots of people.
Now, some people objected to the vaccine, saying they don't think they've been around long enough, unlike, you know, say other vaccines children get that have been around for decades. And they're concerned about what they consider an experimental nature on their kids. You know, don't make our kids lab rats, we were hearing. Can you comment on that concern, please?
Yeah, I have a couple of comments. First of all, there have been over 6 billion doses of COVID vaccines given around the world, 200 million in the United States. To put that in perspective, let's talk about a vaccine everybody knows about, the measles vaccine. We give around 6 or 7 million doses of measles vaccine a year in the United States, 6 or 7 million. And we've given 200 million COVID vaccines. So we actually know a lot more about COVID vaccines than we do any other vaccine.
Yeah, well, that's reassuring to hear. Thank you for sharing that. Are some of the vaccines safer or more effective than others, especially for children?
Well, I can't answer it completely for children because those studies are still ongoing.
Right. And we should note that as of today, I believe the FDA has only approved the vaccines for age 12 and up. Is that right?
Actually only for the Pfizer vaccine.
So right.
The Moderna vaccine is only at this point approved by FDA at 18 and above.
Okay.
That's about to change. The review of the Pfizer vaccine information by FDA for children 5 through 11 years of age is happening later this month.
Mm-hmm.
So I do anticipate we are likely to see a recommendation to start immunizing younger children. back to your basic question about whether some of the vaccines are safer or more effective. In terms of safety, they all have side effects. The side effects are somewhat different between, let's say, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and the Pfizer vaccine. But all of the safety concerns are relatively minor compared to the severity of COVID itself. It is true that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine as a single dose was not quite as effective as the mRNA vaccines as two doses. But as many people will know, the FDA just recommended reviewed the data on a second dose of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and that brings it up to speed with the other vaccines.
Could you address your opinion about whether pregnant women or nursing mothers should get the vaccine?
That question has been clearly answered, and it's incredible that all of the official physician groups who might have an interest in that, such as the Obstetric and Gynecology Group, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the World Health Organization, the CDC, everybody says yes, pregnant women should get immunized. We know that pregnant women are at much higher risk of COVID when they get it, and the babies are at risk too. And by immunizing mom, you can protect both mom and baby.
Yeah, we did have a pregnant mother die just within the last week here in San Diego, kind of driving home that point, die of COVID, I should say. Yeah, the data is out there. And where is the best source for people to go if they want to get information about this? You know, they always say we want to do our own research. Where would you recommend they go that would be reliable sources for that research, Dr. Sawyer?
Yeah, I think the best sources are the Centers for Disease Control or the professional associations like the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, mm-hmm. and Pregnant Women, and the Internal Medicine Group. Another answer to that is just talk to your doctor. Your doctor has been following these stories for the last year and a half and should have the latest information on risk and benefit.
There you go. Can you speak to mask wearing? Some people are asking, you know, why are we still wearing masks when those that are concerned are vaccinated? Can you address that, please?
Well, unfortunately, since Delta has come around, we've learned that even vaccinated people can still get infected and transmit, even if they're not sick. So if we want to really get rid of the pandemic once and for all, we need to keep this transmission down. And masks definitely work to do that. And they're working in schools. They're working at the workplace. Physicians and nurses are all wearing masks all day long. And it's very effective at preventing infection.
Yeah. It's a myth, I understand, people who are concerned that wearing masks could somehow be harmful to kids, to their breathing. Is that correct?
Yeah. Again, I've been wearing a mask for a year and a half. And
my daughter too. Yeah. She's a healthcare worker.
No medical impact and none has been documented anywhere.
Yeah, exactly. Some of the parents also seem to believe that children were unlikely to transmit COVID to other people who might be even more vulnerable than children. Could you please respond to that we were hearing from some of them today?
Yeah, I think that's sort of a residual from the early days of COVID when we thought children were much less likely to transmit. We've learned since then that they are part of the transmission cycle. They spread it to each other in places like school, and then they bring it home to the more vulnerable people who may be in their family. So again, to get over the pandemic, we're going to need to include children in the vaccination and mask wearing campaigns. But if we do that, I'm pretty optimistic that we can get past this once and for all.
Yeah, that was my next question. I do want to throw in here that, I mean, we lost a member of our own family, a 50-year-old man with 5 children who died because his coworker brought in unmasked, unvaccinated teenagers, and one of them gave him COVID, which he then brought home to his whole family. So definitely, you know, you're right. Teens and children can spread it, even if they seem healthy and or even if they're asymptomatic, it's possible.
And that's what's been so tricky about SARS-CoV-2 as a virus. It's very good at infecting people and causing transmission before you're sick or even without making you sick. So that's part of the reason we've had such a problem controlling it.
Do you see light at the end of the tunnel? I mean, we should note that shout out to San Diego, in our region, 89% of those who are eligible for a vaccine, meaning those 12 and up right now, have had at least one dose, and over 80% are fully vaccinated, meaning two doses if you had Pfizer or Moderna. How high do we need to get, do you think, before we'll be out of the woods here and life can return to normal?
Well, I wish I knew the answer to that. It's sort of the million-dollar question. But yeah. San Diego and California generally is doing much better than much of the rest of the country. Evidence for that is we've reopened schools without terrible disaster happening. Although we're seeing some transmission in schools, it's under control because kids are wearing masks and they're isolating as much as they can. And if we add vaccine to that, again, I think we're going to get over the hump and be able to put this back in place. And it may be with us for years to come, but it won't cause this much disruption.
Yeah. What else would you like our viewers and our listeners to know, Dr. Sawyer, about COVID that I may not already have asked you about?
Well, there's been a lot of focus on booster doses and immunizing kids, which are important. But by far, the most important thing is to get the adults who have not been immunized, immunized. That's going to cut down on hospitalizations and deaths, which is still a problem in the United States and around the world. So we need people to get vaccinated.
Yeah, we just put a story up about first responders, the resistance among police unions, a lot of them who think they're, you know, strong and healthy and don't need it. And actually, I was rather shocked to find out that COVID is the leading cause of death among police officers this year and last year, nationally and in California. In California last year, it killed more police officers than every other cause of death combined. The odds nationally of a police officer being killed by COVID-19 were five times higher than being killed in a shootout, which I'm sure is what they're all concerned about.
Wow, I had not heard those numbers. Those are pretty sobering. And if that doesn't convince people to get vaccinated, I don't know what will.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us today, Dr. Sawyer. And feel free to reach out to us anytime you have new information or breaking news on COVID-19 and the vaccines that you would like to share.
All right. Thank you very much. You asked great questions.
Thank you very much.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Law enforcement officers risk their lives daily to protect the public. Yet many have voiced fear over COVID-19 vaccines as their unions push back against mandates. The irony is that according to the Officer Down Memorial page, the greatest risk by far to the lives of police and other law enforcement officers isn't an armed criminal. In 2020 and 2021, COVID-19 killed far more law enforcement officers nationally and statewide than anything else. In California last year, COVID took the lives of more officers than all other causes of death combined. So far this year, COVID accounts for a whopping 231 of the 361 officers who have died, five times more than the 49 felled by gunfire, and far more than from any other cause, such as vehicle crashes, assaults, or heart attacks. Nationally in 2020, of 374 officers who died in the line of duty, 245 lost their lives to COVID-19. Gunfire killed 50. In California last year, 13 of the 18 officers who died perished of COVID-19. COVID accounted for more deaths than all other causes combined. So far in 2021, 25 California officers have died, including 11 from COVID-19, the leading cause of death. That includes two San Diego Sheriff's Department corrections deputies working in the probation department and several Border Patrol agents locally. Paradoxically, many officers willing to brave violence to protect others are resisting rolling up their sleeves and getting the COVID-19 vaccine that could save their lives and the lives of others they might expose. The San Diego Union Tribune reported on October 3rd that only 53% of San Diego Police Department's officers were vaccinated. The Sheriff's Department did not respond to the newspaper's inquiry, and El Cajon refused to release vaccination status of its officers. La Mesa Police reported that 45% of its force had been vaccinated. National City and Chula Vista led the region with 68% and 69% vaccinated. Oceanside ranked lowest at 43%. San Diego has issued a mandate requiring SDPD officers to be vaccinated by December 1st. Police officers come into close contact with the public, so vaccines provide a means of protecting both public safety and the health of city workers, including police officers. COVID-19 not only poses a risk of death, but also disability, since studies show 10 to 30% of COVID survivors have long-haul cases, including damage to lungs, heart, brain, kidneys, or other organs. But moving forward with the mandate could result in a loss of officers, posing a public safety concern of its own. The San Diego Police Officers Association, the union representing officers, surveyed its members in September and found that 90% said they oppose a mandate, 65% would consider quitting, and 45% would rather be fired than comply if the city enforces vaccine requirements. Jack Schaefer, head of the SDPOA, has argued for the city to allow weekly COVID testing as an alternative. The County Sheriff's Department and East County's law enforcement agencies have thus far not required vaccinations, and the Deputy Sheriff's Association has gone on record opposing mandates in a letter sent to the county. The letter warned of a potentially dramatic impact on community policing, as well as staffing in county jails and courthouses, calling mandates, quote, dangerously close to an invasion of personal and privacy rights for members. Border Patrol officers, military members, and other federal workers are mandated to get the vaccine. In addition, local government and private employers with over 100 employees will be required to make sure that workers are vaccinated or provide weekly testing under a new federal Department of Labor rule. A CBS News report on October 15th reports major resistance to vaccine mandates in cities across the nation among police officers, prison guards, airport security officers, and other law enforcement members. Although law enforcement officers in many areas were among the first to be eligible for COVID-19 vaccines as first responders, police and other law enforcement officers continue to have far lower vaccination rates than the public they are sworn to protect. In San Diego County, over 89% of people over age 12 are partially vaccinated and 80% are fully vaccinated, the county's Health and Human Services Department recently announced. Nationally, the White House reported on October 13th, 77% of eligible Americans have received at least one dose of the vaccine. When police officers die in the line of duty from a violent cause, such as a shooting or assault, their deaths are widely publicized and their lives honored with elaborate memorial services and funeral processions through the cities they served. But when an officer succumbs to COVID-19, the cause of death may remain unknown to the public and to fellow officers. Perhaps if as much attention were paid to the 476 American law enforcement officers who have lost their lives to COVID-19 since the pandemic began, more current officers might decide that the risk of getting vaccinated is far lower than the risks posed by the pandemic. Over 403 million doses of COVID-19 vaccines have been administered in the U.S. to date, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. Serious side effects are extremely rare. How rare? Blood clots after the Johnson & Johnson vaccine have occurred in about 7 of every 1 million people vaccinated, mainly in women. But COVID-19 can also cause clots, and at much higher rates than the vaccine. Cases of myocarditis and pericarditis in young people after the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine are similarly very rare, and the risk of heart damage from COVID is far higher. With the new Delta variant that spreads more easily than the original COVID-19 strain, and while mask mandates and social distancing requirements are being lifted in many places, the risk for unvaccinated people to contract COVID-19 is higher than in the past. Newly released Centers for Disease Control data reveal that as of August, unvaccinated adults were 11 times more likely to die of COVID-19 than fully vaccinated adults. In addition, unvaccinated adults are 6 times more likely to catch COVID-19 than fully vaccinated adults. The Officer Down Memorial page offers this advice to law enforcement members. Getting vaccinated is just as important as wearing your vest and your seatbelt. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Elijah McKee.
This is Miriam Raftery with a health alert. A salmonella outbreak in 37 states, including California, has been linked to fresh red, white, and yellow onions imported from Chihuahua, Mexico, and distributed by ProSource, Inc. The outbreak has sickened 652 people as of our press deadline in the U.S. and has resulted in 129 hospitalizations. These onions were sold to restaurants and grocery stores across the United States, according to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, which has not yet issued a recall as it works to determine the exact source of the outbreak. Consumers are advised not to buy or eat any fresh onions unless you know where they were grown. If there's no sticker, or if they're labeled from Chihuahua, Mexico, or ProSource, throw them away or return them to the retailer. Wash any surfaces or containers that the onions touched with hot soapy water and run containers through a dishwasher if you can. Businesses should check coolers and discard any onions of unknown origin or from the contaminated sources. Investigators are working to determine if other onions and suppliers may be linked to this outbreak. Call your healthcare provider right away if you have severe salmonella symptoms such as diarrhea, stomach cramps, high fever, vomiting, dizziness, or dehydration. Symptoms usually start 6 hours to 6 days after consuming contaminated foods with salmonella. Most people recover without treatment after 4 to 7 days, but some, especially seniors, young children, and people with weakened immune systems, may experience more severe illnesses that require medical treatment or hospitalization.
For the fifth consecutive year, San Diego State University and the American Red Cross are teaming up to help hospital patients through the Aztecs for Life Blood Drive. The San Diego community is invited to join Aztecs and CBS 8 at the largest annual collegiate blood drive in California on Tuesday, November 16th from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. at Viejas Arena on the SDSU campus. The blood donations collected will help treat cancer patients, trauma victims, surgery patients, and others requiring life-saving blood transfusions. Right now, the Red Cross has an emergency blood shortage. Donors of all blood types, especially type O, are needed. The blood collected at this special blood drive will help ensure that 115 Southern California hospitals that the Red Cross serves, including 10 San Diego hospitals, have the blood products that patients rely on. Appointments are required and can be made by downloading the free Red Cross Blood Donor app, visiting redcrossblood.org, or calling 1-800-RED-CROSS. As a thank you, those who come to donate blood will receive a t-shirt and gift cards to local restaurants. If you would like to give blood, bring a driver's license, bring a donor card, or two other forms of identification. Donors must be in good health and weigh at least 110 pounds. Donors are asked to wear a face mask regardless of vaccination status. You can learn more about blood donations at redcrossblood.org.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
This is Marie Johnson with an education report. A report by CalMatters reveals that some school districts in San Diego and East County are not providing meals to accommodate students' religious beliefs, even in communities with large populations of Muslim students. The lack of accommodation can also impact Jewish students. Dalal Erekat, a 17-year-old at Valhalla High School in El Cajon, says that on days when she forgets to pack a lunch, she is limited to vegetarian options such as carrot sticks and tater tots, since her school does not provide halal entrees allowed by her Muslim faith. And sometimes the school runs out of options allowed by her faith, such as on pizza day, when cafeteria lines are long and there may be only pepperoni pizza left. El Cajon is home to many Muslim students, including immigrants and refugees from Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and African nations. This year's state budget includes free school meals for all students starting in the 2022-23 school year. But California has never required school districts to offer meals that accommodate students' religious beliefs. Muslims who adhere to a halal diet only eat meat from animals that have been slaughtered, according to Islamic practices. The animal must be killed humanely by a Muslim butcher, and a prayer must be recited during the process. Pork and pork products like gelatin are forbidden by the Quran. Scott Rourke, a spokesperson for the California Department of Education, said districts have flexibility to account for special meals. He said it's up to local districts to align their meals to their student demographics. Grossmont Union High School District, which contains Valhalla High, is currently struggling with the supply chain issues that both schools and the entire food service industry are experiencing, district spokesman Colin McGlashan told CalMatters. He added that normally the district has several vegetarian options each day. McGlashan said the district's nutrition director started meeting with Erica to discuss the issue of halal meals. At the neighboring San Diego Unified District, the state's second largest district, cafeterias are also having to work around the same supply and labor constraints, CalMatters reports. Back in 2015, San Diego Unified did take steps toward a halal meal program by serving a halal chili lime chicken drumstick at one of its high schools. The meal cost about 19 cents more to produce than the typical cafeteria meal, but it attracted 400 more students to the cafeteria lines. The district kept a halal chicken drumstick on the menu until the pandemic closed schools in March 2020. But this year, cafeterias are no longer offering the halal option because of the time and labor needed for production. Adina Botnitsky, a sociologist at University of San Diego who studies Arab-American health disparities, said not offering meals that align with religious or cultural beliefs can hinder students' focus in school and isolate minority student groups. He says offering foods that align with students' religious and cultural beliefs is nutritionally important, educationally important, and symbolically important. While Jewish kosher rules are similar to halal, Botnitsky said kosher meals are less in demand in public school cafeterias because Jewish students who adhere to strict dietary restrictions often attend religious schools. Some public school districts, including Beverly Hills Unified, do offer kosher meals. There is precedent in the United States for serving halal meals at public schools. Dearborn Public Schools, a district outside Detroit, started serving halal meals in their cafeterias in 2001. David Mastonen, a spokesperson for the district, told CalMatters that at first halal meals cost the district about 33% more than their non-halal offerings, but that higher cost vanished as the district scaled up and started buying from halal distributors in larger quantities. The foods are pre-cooked and require the same amount of preparation as non-halal meals once they arrive at the district's cafeterias. Sara Abdi, a parent and advocate in San Diego, wants to bring the same options to her school district. "There's a lot of Muslims at our school, but they're not visible," she says. "I think having options would be awesome."
California is no stranger to severe drought. But while much of the state is straining to conserve water, San Diego seems to have plenty to spare. A recent analysis from the New York Times found that San Diego, over the course of nearly three decades, has become adept at conserving water and at preparing for dry years. The San Diego Water Authority, the agency that manages the county's water supply, has announced that it should have sustainable water supplies through 2045, even if dry conditions persisted for years. This is good news for San Diegans, since the dry conditions that have plagued California are not expected to abate anytime soon. In another stroke of good news, it appears that while climate change-enhanced droughts have wreaked havoc in other parts of the Golden State, San Diego's seasonal rainfall has been largely unaffected by changes to the region's climate. John Stokes, a local photographer and data analyst, has compiled patterns detailing the changes in San Diego's seasonal rainfall. As part of an analysis of local rainfall patterns, Stokes writes that the county's rainfall has been remarkably steady over the years. He goes on to qualify this statement, saying that while rainfall has been consistent, there are additional factors that could contribute to water shortages in the future, such as increased demand for water and warmer temperatures. These warming temperatures increase the need for better irrigation techniques, and, according to Stokes, cause more precipitation to fall as rain instead of snow over the mountains. And with a reduced snowpack, there are reduced snowmelts available to feed some reservoirs during the dry season. Amidst this positive news, San Diegans may be upset to find that even though the total amount of water used by the county is 30% less than it was in 1990, county residents may soon be expected to pay even more for their water. According to the Voice of San Diego, this is because people are using less water, and cities are starting to recycle more of it, meaning the Water Authority can expect to sell less of the water they've already paid to bring here. They make up their costs by raising prices. This is because of the weird payment structure that the Water Authority uses to procure water from outside the region. Essentially, San Diegans are on the hook for a fixed cost even while using less of the product, and so the rate goes up. San Diego has become a national leader and exemplar of good water conservation techniques. The region pulls water from the ocean, buys water from multiple sources, and will soon recycle its gray water as part of its conservation strategy. And a stable rainy season means that the current situation should be expected to continue and even improve as time goes on. That said, key problems remain unsolved. With expected revenue down due to increased conservation, the San Diego Water Authority may find itself unable to pay for upkeep on existing infrastructure or purchase commitments. Even providing less water requires efficient transport and storage, and so rate increases are expected to continue. As long as the Water Authority is dependent on revenue from selling its water, this dilemma will be difficult to resolve. Earlier this week, Governor Gavin Newsom declared a statewide drought emergency, asking all Californians, including all San Diegans, to reduce their water consumption by 15%, though it remains to be seen if San Diego will be able to reduce its footprint even further. The region has done a lot to reduce its total water consumption. As mentioned before, San Diego now uses 30% less water than it did in 1990, and that's not per person, that's in total, even while the population has grown 35% at the same time. It may be time for other regions to do their part. As California comes to experience longer and more severe droughts due to climate change, the state may find itself coming to San Diego with questions. Luckily, San Diego seems to have the answers. Reporting for East County Magazine, I'm Brian Schrader.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities.
This is Marie Johnson with East County Magazine's Tribal Beat Report. Members of the Barona Band of Mission Indians and many other tribal nations have joined a fight aiming to stop the proposed Sandy Valley lithium mine in Arizona. They are also raising concerns over proposed lithium mining at the Salton Sea in Imperial County, California, that could adversely impact Native Americans in our region. Local activist Bobby Wallace led a local contingency of tribal members who traveled in late September to Arizona, where the Hualapai people are battling to stop the Federal Bureau of Land Management from issuing permits for lithium mining that could threaten tribal water supplies. Participants included tribal leaders and tribal council members from the Hualapai Nation and the Peach Springs Tribe, as well as tribal youths and members of the Yavapai Apache people, Mohawk Oneida Tribe, Pueblo, Navajo, Zuni, and San Diego County tribal members from the Kumeyaay and Luiseno, as well as representatives of other activist groups. Lithium is prized for use in cell phones, computers, batteries, and other technology devices, but at a high environmental price for those impacted by hard rock and open pit mining used to extract it. Now, tribal members are urging the federal government to prioritize metal and rare earth mineral recycling over issuance of new mining permits. The Environmental Protection Agency reports that metal mining accounts for 41% of toxic substances released, and hard rock mines may have already contaminated 40% of watersheds in the West, the Arizona Republic reported on October 2nd. Wallace says, "The hot springs and water we are trying to save has been used by the Hualapai people and other First Nations since the beginning. It is an oasis in the desert and very beautiful. But test drilling has already punctured part of the water source at the historic site." Wallace says the new gold rush to derive lithium is moving next to the Salton Sea, which he says is known for sacred sites and oral histories since the beginning for the Kumeyaay, Pechan, and Luiseno people. According to Wallace, about 70 people joined in walking and running across Arizona with the Red Road Warrior Society and the American Indian Movement, Yuman Grassroots Movement, to draw attention to the cause. The group served notices of the Hualapai tribe's opposition to the drilling contractor and to the Federal Bureau of Land Management. The tribal coalition is asking the U.S. Government of the Interior to create new rules to prioritize urban mining, recycling from discarded cell phones, computers, monitors, and batteries over issuing new mining permits. The group also wants updates to the General Mining Act of 1872 with tougher environmental evaluations. In addition, tribes are asking the Biden administration for meaningful tribal consultation to protect indigenous resources. The U.S. lags behind other countries in lithium-ion battery recycling capacity, according to Jeffrey Spangenberger, director of the Resale Center, a consortium of industry, university, and government labs working to create new ways of economically recycling lithium-ion batteries, including those in electric vehicles, soon to reach the end of their lifespan of 12 years. The California Energy Commission wants to cash in on the spike in demand for lithium, known as white gold, for its uses in powering electric vehicles in a fossil fuel-free future, potentially. So the commission has become an angel investor, offering $60 million in grants to companies working to find technically and commercially feasible means of extracting lithium from the brine resulting from geothermal plants at the Salton Sea in Imperial County, just east of San Diego County. Cal Energy Resources, a grant recipient, plans to build a small-scale demonstration plant to start up next year. The Desert Sun reports that it potentially could produce nearly a third of the world's lithium. But at what cost to the people who live in the region, which already has the state's highest rate of asthma and is ranked among the state's most polluted places? The 350-square-mile Salton Sea, cut off from its freshwater supply, has been evaporating, leaving toxic sludge in its wake that has killed fish and sent up dust clouds whipped by the winds, aggravating respiratory health problems. The environmental impacts of the proposed new lithium extraction process from geothermal brine is currently unknown. The pilot project was exempted from environmental review, though a full-scale project should be subject to more rigorous testing. But past citations of some geothermal facilities in the area for failing to properly dispose of hazardous materials and operating without emissions permits raise concerns. For Wallace, concerns over lithium extraction focus mainly on the impacts on water, but he also raises serious questions over how to dispose of the growing number of lithium batteries being produced, increasing the need for recycling valuable raw materials. Besides polluting water wherever lithium is mined, Wallace raises another concern. By 2035, where are we going to put all this non-reusable energy source material? Hundreds upon hundreds of millions of batteries or more on our planet, he asks. The group is planning another action on November 8th to deliver a new letter to the Bureau of Land Management and the drilling company. Wallace says this letter will include the right to protect and preserve sacred sites, water, and Mother Earth for the ancestral land of the Wallapai people.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
This is Elijah McKee with a sports report. Sports fans will soon be able to view local high school sports live on TV. Cox Communications YourView Network has partnered with the California Interscholastic Federation, or the CIF, this year to bring to air top local high school sports matches, including football, basketball, and volleyball, all on Channel 4 in San Diego, as well as streaming on YourView.com. The first game will be Helix High School against Granite Hills High at Granite Hills on October 29th at 7 p.m. The game will also be replayed on November 2nd at 7 p.m. with underwriting from Team Mazda of El Cajon. Gary Seidman, market manager at YourView Network, says, "We are so very excited to bring live local high school sports to our communities across the county and throughout Southern California." He adds that we will be announcing the full lineup of games in the next few weeks.
This is Mitchell Murphy with a public service announcement from the San Diego Humane Society. Creepy costumes, glowing jack-o'-lanterns, and candy make Halloween a treat for kids and grown-ups alike, but they can be scary for our pets and even harm wildlife. So the San Diego Humane Society recommends keeping these tips in mind. Keep pets inside, away from trick-or-treaters and other Halloween activities. To reduce stress levels, keep pets in an enclosed room with their favorite toys and with the television or radio on. Chocolate and other ingredients can be toxic to animals, so keep candy out of reach of pets. Also, be mindful of wrappers and foil, which can be choking hazards for animals. Just because animals look adorable in costumes doesn't necessarily mean that they like it. Don't make your pet wear a costume unless they seem comfortable in it. A simple Halloween bandana can be an alternative to a full costume. Keep jack-o'-lanterns with flames out of reach of your pets, or use flameless candles to prevent curious pets from getting burned. Never leave lit candles outdoors due to fire danger. Also, use caution with fake cobwebs and other decorations that could be a choking hazard for your pet or entangle birds and other wildlife outdoors. Avoid decorations with loops or closed circles, since wild animals can put their heads through a loop or a circle and choke themselves while seeking a meal. Make sure that all of your pets are microchipped and wearing tags with a current ID. Opening the front door for trick-or-treaters creates plenty of escape opportunities for your pet. If your pet does go missing, a pet ID and microchip will ensure a quick reunion. You can schedule an appointment to microchip your pet with your veterinarian or get a low-cost microchipping at any Humane Society location, including El Cajon in East County, by visiting sdhumane.org/microchip.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Crime Beat report. 34-year-old Ricky Bernard Cooper has pleaded guilty to setting an arson fire that burned down the Chase Bank in downtown La Mesa during a riot on May 30, 2020. Cooper also pleaded guilty to a burglary count for looting at the La Mesa Springs Shopping Center. His sentencing is slated for next month. 20-year-old co-defendant Alexander King of San Diego faces the same charges and is due in court in December. Investigators from the La Mesa Police Department, San Diego Police Department, and the San Diego Field Office of the FBI worked jointly to solve these crimes. The riot in La Mesa occurred after a racial justice protest on May 30th that was part of national demonstrations over the killing of George Floyd, a black man, by a white Minnesota police officer since found guilty of murder. Local protesters also targeted La Mesa after a viral video showed La Mesa police officer Matt Dages in a controversial arrest of Amare Johnson, a young black man. Dages was later fired and charged with falsifying a police report, and the charges against Johnson were dropped. Dages' trial remains pending. Chase Bank has indicated it plans to rebuild but has not yet broken ground. Two other buildings, Union Bank and the historic Randall Lamb Building, were also destroyed by arson fires that same night. Daniel Luis Sandoval of Campo was charged with arson at the Randall Lamb Building. He pleaded not guilty and awaits trial. The Randall Lamb lot remains vacant. No one has yet been charged with burning down Union Bank, which recently broke ground to rebuild its downtown location on Spring Street. Anyone with information on these arson crimes is asked to contact La Mesa Police or the FBI.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Issuing invalid subpoena weakens our power, not if somebody votes against it. He has the right to go to the court to see if he has executive privilege or not. I don't know if he does or not, but neither does the committee. So they're weakening the power of Congress itself by issuing invalid subpoena.
House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy blasts House lawmakers for voting on Thursday to hold Steve Bannon in contempt of Congress after he defied a subpoena from the January 6 committee. The Justice Department will now decide whether to press criminal charges. Former President Donald Trump has announced plans to launch a new social media platform called Truth Social. The platform is expected to have a beta launch in November with a wider rollout in 2022. Trump was banned from Twitter and suspended from Facebook earlier this year after his supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol. Despite criticism from Democratic lawmakers, the Biden administration is continuing to expel hundreds of thousands of migrants arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border under a specialized public health order. White House Deputy Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says the discharges will continue for the time being.
We are still expelling single adults and families when possible using Title 42. That remains the policy.
In Washington on Thursday, Vice President Kamala Harris, along with President Joe Biden, spoke at the 10th anniversary celebration of the dedication of the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial on the National Mall's Tidal Basin.
This monument, whatever your age, is dedicated to a man whose voice we can still hear, whose words still echo not only across this city, but throughout our country and our world.
The memorial was dedicated in 2011 and honors King's legacy and struggle for freedom, equality, and justice. The U.S. is expected to face a nationwide shortage of primary care and specialty physicians by 2034. Meanwhile, one in three healthcare workers say they plan to leave the profession, citing burnout. Dr. Brian Miller is an assistant professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins University. He says the doctor shortage has been decades in the making, but will likely be made worse by the pandemic.
Part of it is the loss of sense of control that comes from the pandemic. So people already felt burned out and out of touch, and then the pandemic made that worse as your demands increased.
A new study by the Yale School of Public Health finds natural immunity against the coronavirus appears to be short-lived, and individuals who are unvaccinated can likely expect to be reinfected roughly every 16 to 17 months. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This week, both Congress and the EPA are taking action to combat a class of so-called forever chemicals called PFAS found in thousands of consumer products. But environmental groups say change isn't coming fast enough. On Tuesday, California Senator Alex Padilla co-introduced the PROTECT Act, which would put several types of PFAS chemicals on the EPA's list of hazardous air pollutants regulated under the Clean Air Act. And on Monday, the EPA released a plan to combat PFAS air pollution. But Andrea Ventura with the group Clean Water Action says state authorities should test all water systems and go after polluters.
We have enough data now to recognize PFAS as both persistent and toxic, and we need to take definitive action quickly.
A report from the Natural Resources Defense Council found drinking water systems across California are contaminated with PFAS, with the highest levels found in parts of Alameda, Fresno, Riverside, Santa Clara, and Los Angeles counties. In a statement, the American Chemical Council says not all PFAS chemicals should be regulated in the same way and calls for a science-based approach. PFAS chemicals have been linked to cancers, reproductive problems, high cholesterol, and more. In recent years, California has banned PFAS chemicals in firefighting foam, children's products, and food wrappers. And the state is currently testing soil and water at multiple landfills, airports, military bases, and oil and gas production areas. Ventura says the chemicals are probably even more widespread.
We find PFAS where we don't expect them because these things are not only persistent, but they travel easily in the environment.
Clean Water Action advises people who want to reduce their exposure to PFAS chemicals to avoid nonstick pans as well as items advertised as water, stain, and grease resistant. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine radio show. If you would like to be the media, here's your opportunity. We're looking for some more talented volunteers for our East County Magazine radio show. So if you've got radio experience or just a great voice, or if you'd like to get experience writing scripts or special reports for the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at 619-698-7617 or send an email to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We're your community media, bringing you news from our region that reflects the public interest, not special interests. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.